Mini episode 451 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello and welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 451. I'm FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, and I'm happy to introduce some outstanding guest clips from our last 100 mini episodes. With the variety that is encompassed here, I'm confident that you will hear exactly why the motto "Nothing is off topic" has represented the program from day one. We hope that you enjoy hearing from the following guests: Bob Barker, Kenny Albert, Robert Flores, Lex Luger, Rick Bucher, Nikita Koloff, John Bastow, Troy Vincent, Bobby Brown, and Adam Buckman.
It's a privilege to be able to have these conversations with you, and we've done them largely around special events in your life when you've had things going on, such as last week's 90th birthday celebration with the Price is Right return. It was a very, very special moment. I saw all of the footage and some of the behind-the-scenes footage that went up on the Internet afterward, and it looked like a great day. Did it really completely live up to your expectations?
It was one of the most heartwarming days of my life. They were so nice to me, so good to me, everyone on the show, from the producer right on down, everyone. And the folks came down from upstairs and said hello to me. The new head of daytime came down. Everyone just did everything they possibly could to make it a nice day for me, and they certainly succeeded.
On this realignment, on whether or not the NHL accomplished what they were looking for in year one of this playoff picture, it strikes me that you've got six out of the eight series that feature either new or old rivalries, whether they be divisional rivalries. You have the ancient original six rivalry with Boston and Detroit. On top of that, you have Pittsburgh and Columbus, which is clearly a rivalry that the league would like to see grow. The only one out of these that's really kind of truly random is Montreal and Tampa Bay, but one out of eight is not too bad in that regard, it would seem to me. What do you think about the way that it shook out this year and the playoff picture as opposed to past years?
Well, the thing about Montreal-Tampa Bay, believe it or not, they are now division rivals, so it could turn into quite the rivalry. But
yes.
I kind of see both sides. I didn't mind the old system where it was 1-8, 2-7, and the top team in the conference played the team with the fewest points in the playoffs. The way it could work out this year, for example, for the Bruins, if they move on, they might play a team with a better record than the Rangers or Flyers. So by finishing with the top seed, more points than the number two team, Pittsburgh, if those are the two teams who advance, Pittsburgh could actually get the team with less points because of the divisional setup. But I do like the rivalry aspect of it. You know, we haven't seen Rangers Flyers in the playoffs since 97 and Detroit and Boston since the 1950s. And, you know, you got two of the three California teams playing in the West. So that part of it I like, because I think it just makes it even more entertaining for the fans and for the media and those of us who we'll have the opportunity to attend and work the games. But, you know, I think there's never going to be a perfect system, whether it's the 1-8, 2-7, or the way it is now with the top three in each division and the wild cards. But it's pretty good. You know, we'll see how it goes. It's the first year. One thing I do like is the bracket system for the second round, where you know who you're going to play. If the Rangers advance, they know it's going to be the winner of the Pittsburgh-Columbus series. I kind of like that aspect of it.
Part of the reason Michigan State's offense looked as good as it did was a very, very lackluster performance by the Ohio State defense. And I can tell you from being there in the crowd that night, Robert, a lot of people in scarlet and gray just shaking their heads at what happened. But couldn't have been too big of a surprise after the Michigan game the previous week. But you know, Ohio State, of course, that means that they're not going to get a chance to get obliterated by Florida State, because if you can't stop Michigan State, you got no hope for stopping the Seminoles. What do you think when you check out that team, Robert? This is one of these things where in the last couple of years, I personally have touted Florida State only to see them fall apart at one point or another. Is it all Jameis Winston this year that basically made them too good to stumble at any point in time along the way, or is there more to the story than that?
Well, I think it's, you know, Jameis Winston certainly deserves a tremendous amount of credit, but Jimbo Fisher and his coaching staff, especially on the offensive side of the ball, I think they deserve the most credit, because when you look at Jameis Winston play, he is fundamentally sound. His mechanics are pretty good. Obviously, there's always room for improvement, but he's still a very young player. But he is he's so good with his mechanics, and you can just tell he has received some good coaching in his two seasons there at in Tallahassee. Obviously, last year he was a redshirt freshman. But I just think that they have so much talent on the offensive side of the ball. Defensively, they're good. It's just, you know, up and down their roster, they're just blessed with talent. But I think Jimbo Fisher has done a tremendous job and should get most of the credit, for, as well as his coaching staff.
Do you get any sense from going to what happened after the NFC Championship game with Richard Sherman? There's a lot of people that are making Brian Tillman circa 96 analogies. Does that ring any bells from back in the day when you were watching or participating in Four Horsemen promos, what that guy did on the stick at the end of the game there?
I gotta say, it was pretty shocking. For a lot of people who were watching, just the expression was priceless on Erin Andrews' face. I mean, you could see she's like really taken back by his intensity. It was it would have been definitely a vintage Horseman type interview, without a doubt. There was intensity and fire in his words, and they definitely caught him up in the moment of the competitive juices flowing, without a doubt.
That infamous series against Boston, which I have to say Cavs fans are trying to forgive and forget back in 2010. Easier to forgive than
you
forget,
can never
I suppose.
Forget. You can never forget that one.
No, it is burned in my brain. And I will tell you too, Rick, on a personal note, my birthday was on Game 5. I sat there and watched that atrocity
wow.
on my birthday, and it's one of the defining.
That's just not fair. That's just not fair.
No, sure
it is. Nobody deserves that.
No, I'm shuddering thinking of it now. It was so awful.
Actually, what did you do to deserve that? That's what I need to know. What did you do? What have you done that you would deserve something like that?
I had to have murdered entire villages in a past life to have deserved that, I guess. If indeed I did deserve it, if we buy that premise when your character changed as it did. That was, of course, after Magnum T.A.'s very unfortunate car accident. In terms of the formation of that and the Superpowers tag team with Dusty Rhodes, how did that come together? I know that everybody was in a real sense of shock and grief at the time, but how did the wheels start turning to eventually turn you into a character to take Magnum's place next to Dusty?
Well, it's an interesting story because, you know, up to that point, of course, you know, the Russian guys have always been the heels, always been the bad guys. And I actually came back from a tour in Japan with the Giant Baba over there. And I was actually in Philadelphia the first night I got the news of Magnum's accident. I thought they were kidding me. I was up in the room with Jim Crockett, the promoter, and Dusty Rhodes, and they were sharing with me what had happened. And it took them a while to convince me that they were really weren't just ribbing on the square, but that they were really, you know, that they were this was for real, and not just trying to pull my leg. And once they convinced me of that, then they went on to say that they had an idea, and unfolded the idea, and the idea was for me to make a turn and become tag team partners with Dusty, which had, again, never really been done before with a Russian. And, you know, said, you know, take a day or two, you know, think it over, think about it. And, you know, if you're open to doing that, then that's what we'll do. And that's kind of how it all unfolded in a dressing room in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Once upon a time, we might have thought, well, some people anyways, that it would be equally outlandish to consider Jim Carrey winning the Academy Award for Best Actor as perhaps Matthew McConaughey. Maybe I'm exaggerating slightly.
Agree.
But
no, I agree with you 100%. After days
really?
Of confusion, I agree
okay.
with you 100%. But it's almost like Cher back in the day. I mean, back in my parents' day and stuff like that. I mean, even when my friends, you know, in school and stuff like that said, oh, Cher is like an icon and everything. I mean, my parents used to say, well, when she started out, they treated her as a joke. I mean, she was considered a joke in the beginning, much like Suzanne Somers on Three's Company was sort of a joke. And then all of a sudden she becomes a multi-billionaire with, a giant multi-brand empire, and Cher becomes an icon. Matthew McConaughey, I think, is honestly doing the same thing. I mean, he started out in, like, stoner films, and nobody would have taken it seriously, much like, I guess, Jake Gyllenhaal started out in Bubble Boy. But there is a change. And that's what I'm talking about even when you say about the Ellen thing. You say, like, well, everybody says, oh, you know, she wasn't honoring it. She changed it a little bit. There's always going to be resistance to change, and then you're going to be praised for change once it's accepted. But it's not going to be immediately accepted and immediately praised by everyone. Same thing with Matthew McConaughey. He went through a career arc. His career has changed. He started out in one thing, and he has grown and grown and grown as an actor. And then he did such a dramatic transformation for Dallas Buyers Club, where he became the role. And he, as he talks about in the after-show interviews, and has also talked about in several magazines, I mean, the funding of the project, he was involved in every aspect of it. This was his baby. He was so committed to knowing about every step, even if other people were handling different steps, but just being involved in everything because that was the passion. And that passion shows through, and that passion wins awards.
Well, and that's what's really exceptional about the accomplishment that he had there. I mean, I saw James Lipton on TV this morning on a show trying to kind of make sense of it and walk his way through it a little bit. But in my own mind, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking there are so few comparisons out there in American culture to what it is to win Best Actor or Best Actress. So you can't even look at it like a sports MVP for a season because it's much bigger than that. If you're going to look at it anyway, maybe it's like being the heavyweight champion of the world in boxing when that still meant something. But you're basically in the Hall of Fame at this point. If you've won that, you're on a list of the greatest actors and actresses of all time, and nobody can ever take that away from you, unlike a Heisman Trophy or something where it can be subsequently. So he's on that list now. I mean, Kate Blanchett won last night for Best Actress, and I think we all looked at it and was like, yeah, okay, she was going to make that list at some point. And it was just a matter of time. Nobody blinked when she won it, not least of which because her role that she played was so great this time. But it's a numbers game, right? She's going to win it one of these times because she is universally recognized as being that great. McConaughey, yeah, scratching his way up onto that tier of actors is, as you said, truly phenomenal.
It's funny. I mean, not to leave topic a little bit, but it reminds me so much. You ever see these events where, like, you see, like, the predicted people that are supposed to be on top, and then all of a sudden somebody just sneaks through the pack and snatches it and then runs away with it?
Almost, yeah.
back in the Olympics, back in the day, when I was in grammar school or junior high or something like that, there was I'll never forget this story. There was a figure skater, Sarah Hughes, who won at the Olympics, won gold. She was not expected to win gold. It was between other competitors. I don't know, Surya Bonaly or Nancy Kerrigan or Tanya Hart. No, Michelle Kwan, who will always be in history as a great skater. But whenever they say Michelle Kwan's name, they always say, never won an Olympics. That's all you hear. Anyway, Sarah Hughes was from America, and she was like the also-ran type of thing who was, you know, competing for us. All of a sudden, she does a couple of phenomenal performances, blows away the competition of what they thought she could do, sneaks up to win the gold, just snatches the gold out of everyone's hand. She becomes a little icon. And then all of a sudden, I never heard her skate again. She didn't become like the dancing turnip in the Ice Capades or anything like that. But it's like, that's the way I would be if you in that type of award. You know, if you win that type of award, especially when you win it against all odds, you just stop because you already won the ultimate. You can only go down from there. And I think that's what Matthew McConaughey did with this award, but he just repeated it over all the awards because he did so well in all the other award shows too. But he came out of the blue. The only difference is everybody knew the movie was good. Everybody knew the movie had buzz. So there was already talk about him as being a possible contender for the Oscar. So it's not like he totally snatched it like Sarah did, completely out of the blue with nobody talking about it. But, you know, that movie was a tour de force for him. And I think the main reason that what resonated about it besides his performance was his passion. I think that was what resonated with a lot of the voters in the Academy and in these other award shows.
I'm calling this the Harvey Schiller question because when we had Dr. Schiller on the show, in 7 years, out of all the guests that we've had, he's the only person I ever thought to ask this of, and you're the second person because I look at some of the influences that you've had. For him, he'd worked under General Curtis LeMay, Ted Turner, George Steinbrenner, worked with Billy Payne, Eric Bischoff. So he had a lot of figures that were very strong-willed and that really kind of taught him a lot. And I asked him a little bit about that. I'm going to pose the same question to you because just in terms of the more prominent names, Don Shula, Andy Reid, Joe Gibbs, a cup of coffee in the offseason with Jimmy Johnson before he signed with Philadelphia. So, you know, and I'm sure there's, you know, quite a lot of others that have made an impact on you as well. Barry Alvarez, a name that I hadn't thought to put to the list until now. So what are some of the things that you've picked up from these gentlemen, and are there any kind of common traits that you've seen among them?
Yes, well, one, you name the obvious. You name the more recognizable faces. But I would say, you know, my grandfather, who was a World War II vet, Jefferson Vincent, you know, my mother, James and Linda Bolly, who were my guardians as I attended Pensbury High School. James, Jim Dundella, who was my high school head. I learned more from Jim Dundella than I learned from any coach. The real values of football, who was my high school coach at Pensbury High School there in Lower Bucks County. But the visible, when you talk about Don Shula, Joe Gibbs, we're talking about Hall of Fame coaches and Hall of Fame leaders. But it's the everyday people that had the most influence on me because that's who I saw every day. And I know what I can be. We talk about this all the time, is that people know what they can be by what they see, not what they hear. And I had some great people, great individuals, hardworking. I come from a blue-collar family. And I had an opportunity every day watch Grandpa go to work, Grandma go to work, watch Mom go to work. And those were really leaders. And Grandpa always said, it doesn't matter what someone's done to you. The most important thing is how you respond. You can't control what people say to you, but what you control is how you respond. And that's a sign of leadership. I work with a great leader in Commissioner Goodell, great leader in Robert Gulliver and Jeff Pash, some wonderful leaders at the National Football League, doing some phenomenal work. I get a chance to gleam and share insight with these individuals on a daily basis.
You obviously weren't thinking of what you were going through at the time, at least on a conscious level, as being any kind of a cautionary tale. And, yeah,
right.
You as a mother obviously know that that's how it's going to be read at this point in time here. So do you feel that there's a lot that comes out of this constructively for parents to be able to pass on to their kids and say, hey, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll lifestyle here, here's some consequences of it. Do you feel like it's serving a purpose in that way?
I do. I honestly do. I had a girl write to me from her high school and said that my book was like their theme or their motto to, you know, kind of for women, like what not to do. I guess I could say I'm kind of the poster child for what not to do. You know, I mean, you know, because there's so many girls who think that it's so glamorous and like to come out here and date a rock star and do this and do that. They all had imagined my life was a certain way. They had no idea that it was the way that it was. And they, you know, had envy back then. And now they don't, and you know, realize that it was all for nothing. In their mind, basically. So I guess, you know, it is a cautionary tale, and it is good advice to give because, you know, when I came out here, I didn't know what I was going to, you know, what I was bargaining for, or what I had, you know, lied in store for me waiting, you know what I mean? Like, so I just had to kind of live it. Nobody out here wants to warn you or tell you anything anyway, but everybody makes their own bed. So it's like people could have told me a million things and I probably would have done it anyway. But you know, definitely – it's definitely a warning in some respects, and then what you should or shouldn't do or get involved with, basically.
I can see where, again, you might have getting some strong opinions at the time if you were thinking that Seinfeld's show might have been losing it a bit at the beginning of season 9.
Well, what you're talking about is, of course, 3 weeks into season 9, the New York Post television section, when I was editor, we published an innocuous poll of our readers, this kind of thing where they were supposed to clip it out and fax it to us because the fax machine was the technology of the day, and tell us if they thought Seinfeld was not as good as it had been for 8 seasons. And, you know, in retrospect, the Cremerica Industries episode with, you know, the intern and everything was a terrific episode. And, you know, and George was working for Playnow Industries and,
yep.
You know, it just, you know, it was, it, you know, in retrospect, sure, it's fine. And at the time, though, we felt like, gee whiz, this seems like the same old thing with Seinfeld. And that's the other thing I wanted to bring out in the book is that when you're working in daily newspapers, you have to feed the thing every day. So you have to have ideas coming out of your ears, you know. So on that particular day, we thought, let's raise some conversation about Seinfeld. And so we put this blank, like, in the paper and said, you know, write your opinion. Is Seinfeld going downhill or something? And to our amazement, Jerry Seinfeld himself called the editor-in-chief to try to stop the Post from publishing the results of this idiotic poll that coming weekend. And the editor wouldn't let him get away with that. He said, no, we have to run it because, you know, we already told the readers we'll run the results. And he convinced Jerry to do an interview with one of our reporters. And so we got an interview with Jerry that we ran next to the poll results. I don't even know what the poll results were. I think it was about even. You know something, Rick? We were lucky if we got 80 responses. You know, I mean, you know how, you know, it was meaningless. But what you're referring to is that a few months later, this thing ran in October, a few months later, Jerry did make the famous Christmas Day announcement that Seinfeld would end that spring. And then he gave an interview to Time magazine where he said he made the decision because he wanted to get off stage on a high note when he was still number one and the show was still good. And he understood that there were some critics in a few places beginning to sort of take a second look at the show and not enjoying it as much as before. Whether he was referring to the New York Post TV section, I have no idea, but it is true that I don't remember anyone else criticizing it at the time. I just remember us doing it. So there are those who are saying maybe the Post had a role in convincing Jerry that this was the time to get off stage at that high note. If that's the case, I certainly don't feel great if I helped drive Jerry Seinfeld off of TV, but all things being equal, maybe it was the time for it to go. And as we know, the episodes that we're left with are some of the most, as a nine-season television show, they're the finest shows that were ever made.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.